Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, Pope Benedict will be heading to the historic City of the Popes this weekend. We'll have a preview. Rome's Lateran Palace, one of the first homes of the popes, in episode 10 of our series, Vatican Centuries. And Australians want to see this little lady become a saint. We find out who she was. Pope Benedict will pay a pastoral visit to the central Italian towns of Viterbo and Bagnoregio on Sunday to pray with the local faithful, visit what is known as the medieval city of the popes, and pay tribute to the area's saints. In Viterbo, Pope Benedict will visit one of the number of other places outside the Sistine Chapel, where conclaves were held to elect new popes. The northern Latium city is home to the Palace of the Popes, the seat of the papacy for a period of 24 years in the 13th century. Five conclaves were held here for the election of five popes, from Urban IV in 1261 to Martin IV in 1281. Pope Benedict will pause to reflect in the conclave hall before proceeding to the Fall Valley, where he will celebrate an open-air mass. The Pope will then pray at a Marian shrine and at the sanctuary of the 13th century Viterbo saint Rosa.
When the Holy Father comes, we will be celebrating the feast days of Santa Rosa.
Viterbo Bishop Lorenzo Chiarinelli says everyone is excited about Pope Benedict's arrival and his visit to the shrine of Santa Rosa.
È una giovane.
She was a young, simple girl who was even rejected by the Clarissan order. She was just 18 years old when she died, but she was intimately involved in the problems of her times, the social challenges of poverty, marginalization, conflict. Though her health was by no means good, she offered a true example of the faith, of charity.
Well, moving on later to the small town of Bagnoregio, just a few miles away from Viterbo, Pope Benedict will pray at the St. Nicholas Cathedral, which contains the relics of another 13th century saint, Bonaventure. Pope Benedict is particularly fond of this saint, who was born around 1217 in the breathtakingly beautiful hilltop town of Civita di Bagnoregio.
San Bonaventura è dottore della Chiesa.
In 1257, a tumultuous time within the Franciscan family, Bonaventure was elected head of the order. Under his guidance, harmony was re-established within the community. Pope Sixtus IV canonized him saint. And for his many theological and spiritual writings, Sixtus V later proclaimed him a doctor of the Church. As a young theologian preparing to teach, Joseph Ratzinger chose as his 1957 thesis the theme Saint Bonaventure, the Theology of History, based on some of the saint's last writings. So, what has made Saint Bonaventure so special in the eyes of this pope?
His attention to the reading of history, because today we tend to sometimes read history in an evasive way, an escapist way. History becomes something to push aside. It's become all or nothing. Either it's time or eternity, or either it's God or man, or soul or body. But living the faith in light of Bonaventure's teachings means Christ and our hope in salvation remain the focus of our lives, no matter what is going on around us. This doesn't mean he advocated escaping from the challenges posed by history, time, or society. Quite the contrary. In the collective research on this saint, Joseph Ratzinger's thesis on Bonaventure is therefore very relevant for our times.
Anche oggi ci riconsegna con grande attualità.
Well, as I said before, in visiting Viterbo, Pope Benedict XVI will be a pontiff going back to the city of the popes.
Innanzitutto questo era patrimonium sancti petri.
Above all, this was patrimonium sancti petri. Viterbo was called the city of the popes because the conclave was held here in the bishop's palace. It was here in this historical room that the famous conclave was held over a period of 33 months, which elected Blessed Gregory X. In this room, five pontiffs were elected. Four were buried here in Viterbo, in the cathedral, and in the Church of St. Francis. In Viterbo, we've also had 50 popes visit or live with us. Throughout the second half of the 1200s, Viterbo was the home of the popes, so there's a strong historical link between Rome and our city. So this visit by the Pope today undoubtedly touches the very soul of this city and surrounding towns because of Viterbo's unique historical link with the papacy, and it fills us with hope for our future. Our historical sites act as reminders about how we should be living our faith now, in today's historical, social and cultural context. A faith that, in a world full of contradictions, aims to be a sign of brotherhood for all and a force for good, such as that the Pope described in his encyclical Charity in Truth.
La carità nella verità.
Bishop Lorenzo Chiarinelli of Viterbo. Well, after his visit to Viterbo and Bagnoregio on Sunday, Pope Benedict will be returning by helicopter to the papal residence at Castel Gandolfo outside Rome. And do stay tuned to Vatican Radio on Sunday and on Monday for updates on this papal visit.
Chapter 10, Lateran Interlude.
The centuries advanced, and as the buildings on the Vatican Hill grew in size and importance, another spot on the opposite bank of the river had its own share of the limelight.
A spot which for 1,000 years was the home of the popes, the Lateran.
In the time of Nero, there lived a Roman playboy named Plautius Lateranus. His family possessed a splendid palace to the far southeast of Rome, just within the walls and with a magnificent view of the Alban Hills.
Plautius was described by Juvenal the satirist as the bloated Lateranus, who whirls past the bones and ashes of his ancestors in a swift car. But this good-time boy came to a bad end. Not content with debauchery, he began to meddle in politics and joined the plot to assassinate the emperor. When it was discovered, the conspirators were executed, Plautius among them.
Nero promptly confiscated the Lateran property. Later it became part of the dowry of Fausta, wife of Constantine the Great. When Constantine emancipated Christianity, he made a gift of the Lateran to Pope Melchiades, and there the popes resided until their exile to Avignon in 1303.
St. Peter's and the Vatican are so much more famous and familiar to us than the Lateran that they've rather overshadowed this older home of the popes. It's hard for us today to imagine that for 1,000 years the word Lateran brought much the same image to mind as Vatican does today. As the pilgrim of old reached the end of the Via Merulana, the great church and Lateran palace suddenly came into view on the top of a hill, with a ruined Aurelian wall at a lower level, and in the distance, the uninterrupted view of the Alban Hills. St. Peter's was built on a man-made site, but the site of the Lateran was a natural one. Like St. Peter's and all Constantine's foundations, St. John Lateran faces the rising sun. Its great bronze central doors are very ancient. They come from the Curia Hostilia of the Roman Forum, in which the Roman Senate met. On a frieze between the higher and lower porticos, the ancient inscription may be seen, solemnly declaring the will of the Pope and of the Emperor, that this temple shall be considered the first and the mother of all churches. Although excavations have brought to light the houses of the Lateran family, and even the barracks of the Emperor's bodyguard, no one knows for certain just where the first papal palace stood. Probably it was in the area between where the Scala Santa is today and the present basilica. The Scala Santa is traditionally believed to be the staircase ascended by Christ in the palace of Pontius Pilate in Jerusalem, brought to Rome by St. Helena.
When Pope Melchiades moved into the Lateran in 313, it was still the Domus Faustae, Fausta's house, and in the baths of this Roman house, the Pope held a synod to combat the Donatist heresy. After the synod, the first service of baptism was held in these same baths. Later on, Constantine built a circular baptistry on the site. A century later, another octagonal building replaced it and can be seen there to this day. This baptistry is famous for its so-called singing doors. When they're moved, they make a curious musical sound. Made of gold, silver, and bronze, they are said to have come from the baths of Caracalla.
The first papal palace at the Lateran was probably built in the reign of Pope Sylvester, successor of Melchiades, after the death of the Empress Fausta. Today, all that is left of this first papal palace and the original basilica are the Sancta Sanctorum, the private chapel of the popes, and the baptistry.
The first basilica had a lively history. It was destroyed by the Vandals, restored, again destroyed by earthquake, and twice by fire. It was not until the middle of the 17th century that the architect Borromini was commissioned to carry out a complete reconstruction. But a great part of the history of Europe took place in the old Lateran Palace, and the destiny of the church was decided at the councils held there.
All the popes of the Middle Ages lived at the Lateran, and 28 of them are known to have been buried there, although few tombs have survived. In the year 1300, Boniface VIII announced the first holy year from the loggia of the Lateran. The scene was later recorded by Giotto in a fresco in the loggia, but today only a fragment of the fresco is preserved in the modern basilica. Opening out of the loggia was the Aula Concili, where the papal elections took place.
This great room was built in the 9th century by Pope Leo III and was to house 5 ecumenical councils. It was next to the basilica and must have been very impressive. It contained an apse with stained glass windows and a triptych in which Christ was the central figure.
About the time of the coronation of Charlemagne in 800, a great triclinium was built, and in this room the popes entertained the emperors to a banquet after their coronation.
In 1377, when Pope Gregory XI returned to Rome from Avignon, he found the Lateran practically uninhabitable, so he went to live in the Vatican. In the 16th century, Pope Sixtus V pulled down what remained of the Lateran after fire, earthquake and riot, and in 1586 replaced it with the present building, designed as a summer residence by Domenico Fontana.
The original Lateran Basilica was the first great Christian church ever to be built, just a few years before St. Peter's. Its mosaic of the Saviour was the first picture of Christ to be seen in a public place. Today the Pope no longer resides in the Lateran, but the Basilica of St. John Lateran has retained its importance as the cathedral of the Bishop of Rome. This dignity and this primacy is confirmed by the words inscribed on each side of the main entrance door. The Most Holy Church of the Lateran, Mother and Head of all the Churches of Rome, and of the world.
Whether a hovel or a palace, it is only people who can bring a place to life, and with the Lateran it is no different. Many were the popes who inhabited it, but of one in particular this story is told.
In the spring of the year 1209, two men met in the Lateran Palace. One was Pope Innocent III, one of the most forceful personalities ever to occupy the chair of Peter. The other was Francis of Assisi, who had come to Rome to seek papal approval of his rule. The contemporary chronicler, Matthew Paris, describes their encounter.
On that spring morning, long ago, Francis of Assisi walked into the Lateran Palace with no particular ceremony and went up to the Pope. But his appearance was such, his poor tunic, his tangled locks, and his great black eyebrows, that Innocent III pretended to take him for a swineherd. "Leave me alone with your rule," he exclaimed. "Go find your pigs instead. You can preach all the sermons you want to them." Francis was not a bit put out. He rushed off to the nearest pigsty and smeared himself all over with dung, then presented himself again to the Pope. Innocent was impressed, and thinking it over, he regretted having given him so ill a reception. And after sending him away to get washed, he promised him another audience. On the second occasion, the cardinals were also present, and when Francis presented his program, they protested at its literal interpretation of the gospel. It was beyond human strength, they declared, and the Pope was inclined to agree. He told Francis and his companions, "Although your zeal, my dear sons, reassures us, we must nevertheless think of your successors, who may find the path you wish to follow too austere." But one of the cardinals had already spoken to Francis and was won over to his way of thinking. He spoke up. "If we reject this poor man's request on such a pretext, would not this be to declare that the gospel cannot be practiced, and so to blaspheme Christ, its author?" Innocent was shaken, but he was not going to give way yet. "My son," he said to Francis, "pray to God to manifest his will to us. When we know it, we shall be able to give you an answer with perfect surety."
And so Francis prayed God to touch the heart of the Pope, and Innocent dreamed a dream.
He thought he saw the whole edifice of St. John Lateran, with all its domes and turrets, leaning perilously over to one side, as if threatened by earthquake and about to topple over any minute. But just at that moment, a figure appeared, small and ragged and somehow familiar, and ran to the building and with a simple push, straightened it up and held it so with his shoulders. It was Francis. Innocent recognized him at once, and realized that the humble friar was necessary for the salvation of the church. He approved the rule.
And the church was the richer for the coming of the little poor man.
She was a lady who wouldn't take no for an answer, not when illness and fate partially crippled her as a child, nor when people told her she was attempting the impossible by ministering to the poor in a Sydney suburb. Eileen O'Connor never outgrew the size of a child, but her work with the poor and needy in the seaside neighborhood of Coogee gave her a giant-sized reputation for kindness and determination. By the time she died at just 28, Eileen had established Our Lady's Nurses for the Poor, a small group of dedicated nurses who cared for the sick. Almost a century later, Eileen's nurses have become a congregational order of sisters called Our Lady's Nurses.
She was quite determined, and she just kept battling away, and she did so in ways that you just have to admire her.
John Hosey tells her story in his biography, Eileen, The Life of Eileen O'Connor.
If we're to become holy, we need to do so in a context, the context of our lives. And Eileen's life was lived in extraordinary pain, far beyond anything that most of us experience. She was confined to a bed for long periods, and yet she achieved a great closeness to God and to His Blessed Mother. She reached out with great compassion, and that was far more difficult for her than for most people, because she was confined to a bed for such long periods. And yet she understood their need and worked out a system of helping them, which was very effective and continues to the present day. She also had a great effect on other people. They came to see her and to listen to her. They asked her about their problems. They asked her for prayers to help them or to help members of their family. And yet when they did so, she often said to them, "Would you pray for me?" And literally got them to do so right there in her room, which surprised them. But it showed an understanding of how she saw the value of other people's prayers. I think these are some of the things that I found about Eileen that make me convinced that she's a very special person.
Our Lady's Nurses have put forward an application to make Eileen O'Connor a saint. Do you think she'll make it?
It's difficult to say that, but as a church historian, I can think of a great many who we call saints who wouldn't match up to Eileen's level of personal holiness and to the simple goodness which she achieved in her life. She's also a lay person. I think we have often overlooked the way in which lay people lived and so forth. The church hasn't recognized people like Eileen often enough. And it's very important then because of that side of her and her deep spirituality.
Besides these very important qualities, let's say, her body is reported to have remained incorrupt. Also, she reportedly had visions of the Virgin Mary, and some people have even said that they've been healed of their illnesses in her presence. How much truth is there in these stories?
There's a lot of validity in that these things were recorded and reported at the time. For instance, that one of the nurses wrote to her mother within 3 days, describing with an extraordinary excitement almost of what she saw, and described it in detail which I've quoted in the book, which tell of just how much that meant to her. But at the same time, it's something that I saw when I was going into the convent at Nevers, where the incorrupt body of Saint Bernadette is preserved. There's a sign in French that says, "Bernadette is not a saint because she saw Our Lady, but because of the kind of life she led afterwards."
Very thought-provoking words there, of course. Let's go back another moment. Eileen never saw her application accepted for Vatican recognition of her small congregational order. That wasn't to come until 1953, which was 33 years after her death. Why did it take so long?
There were a number of reasons, but among them were the facts that she had been through a great many difficulties at the time of her life. She had been struggling to see the nurses and their work recognized. There was a priest, Father Ted McGrath, a Sacred Heart father, who worked with her and helped her a great deal, making up for her lack of physical mobility and so forth by being prepared to go out and do things and meet people. And he became the target of a priest who was sent out to look at difficulties in his order in Australia at the time. This priest decided to make examples of Father McGrath and another priest, even though theirs were not the issues on which he'd been sent to Australia. And he expelled Father McGrath from the Sacred Heart Order and also from the priesthood. Afterwards, Eileen said to Father McGrath, "You're not going to receive justice in Australia. If you want justice, you'll have to go to Rome." And so, despite all her own physical disabilities, she encouraged him to go to Rome, and she herself travelled with a nurse companion and chaperone. They got to Rome and they fought out the cases. Father McGrath was reinstated in his order. Eileen's case did not have success in that application, and for those reasons, and also because the Archbishop of Sydney was not supporting her at that time, he did so after her death, there was no question of the possibility in her short life of progressing the order towards establishment. That was undertaken by Cardinal Norman Gilroy in the early 1950s, as you said.
What would you say Eileen's legacy is today?
Her legacy is a person who was crippled by an accident when she was a child and never was more than 115 centimetres, that's about 3 foot 10 inches in height. For that reason, disregarded by a lot of people as trivial and unimportant. Today, I think a lot more attention is paid to people who are disabled in some kind of way. She's an example for them. She's an example for all of us who face pain, and often people facing that have very little to cling on to. She wasn't living in an age when the medicines that are today used to counteract pain were used, even though they were available, for anyone with an ongoing pain. And so the pain she faced was extraordinary. She's also a very bright and cheerful kind of a person. She loved children and she spent time with them. So that in all of those ways, she stands to us as somebody we can look up to. She can be a person for Australia, as somebody very special, and we don't have enough who are giving examples like that. We have Mary MacKillop. We have another who founded a religious order, is now Blessed Mary MacKillop. We have Caroline Chisholm, who did extraordinary work helping migrant girls travelling to Australia and looking after them when they arrived. And here's Eileen at the beginning of the 1900s doing work among poor people when a government did nothing to help them in any kind of way that enabled them to even see a doctor, let alone go into hospital if they were ill.
John Hosey, church historian and author of the book Eileen, The Life of Eileen O'Connor. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.